New Season Watch Pod explores nature as the seasons change. We're talking about anything that might be. Maybe it is about what time you go to bed. Text us, 218-326-1234. Don't forget, KEXE was chosen for Newsmatch 2025, a national campaign supporting local nonprofit newsrooms like ours. You have been there for us. You helped us get where we are today, and now the gift can go even further. We have over $35,000 in matching funds to support strong local journalism across northern Minnesota. Your gift will be matched 3-1. You can get local news anytime at our website. It is being updated all the time, including stories on how resources are available for woodland owners after Bemidji area blowdown. We've also got stories about Northlanders that won 3 medals at state swimming and diving meets and Northland football team season and how it turned out. Check it all out at KAXE.org. It's a minute after 6.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Federal immigration authorities say they've arrested nearly 200 people in a sweep in Charlotte, North Carolina. Now, the mayor of Raleigh, North Carolina, says immigration officials will launch operations in her city. From member station WUNC, Bradley George reports.
Raleigh Mayor Janet Cowell says she doesn't know how long the operation will last or when agents would be present. She says crime is down in North Carolina's capital city and a federal presence is not needed. In a statement, Cowell asks Raleigh residents to, quote, remember our values and maintain peace and respect through any upcoming challenges. Border Patrol and ICE agents began a sweep through Charlotte over the weekend. Many businesses and immigrant communities have closed, and the city school system reported nearly 21,000 absences on Monday. The Department of Homeland Security has said it's focusing on North Carolina because of what it calls sanctuary policies that it says limit cooperation between local authorities and immigration agents. For NPR News, I'm Bradley George in Chapel Hill.
The House of Representatives is expected to vote today to require the Justice Department to publish all documents related to late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Last night, women who have accused Epstein of sexual abuse gathered in Washington to urge more lawmakers to vote in favor of the measure. That includes Danielle Bensky. She says she is working with young people as a dance instructor.
I work with a lot of younger kids. I work with a lot of teenagers that were the same age that I was at that time. And I look at their faces and I look at how young they are, and I just want to be an advocate for change for them. I want to make the world safer for them.
President Trump told Republicans this week to vote for the measure. But President Trump already has the authority to tell the Justice Department to release all the documents now. The UN Security Council has backed a peace plan for Gaza. The resolution authorizes an international force there for the next 2 years. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports the U.S. is calling this a significant step for the Middle East.
U.S. Ambassador Mike Waltz says the world has the power to, quote, douse the flames and light the path to peace. He praised the Security Council for backing a plan to set up a board of peace led by President Trump and to authorize an international force to coordinate with Egypt and Israel.
The resolution today provides troop contributing countries with the framework they need for moving forward with the International Stabilization Force and global financial institutions, the mechanisms they need for channeling investment.
The U.S. ambassador calls this resolution just the beginning. Russia, which proposed a different draft, abstained from the vote. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
You're listening to NPR. President Trump is set to welcome Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman to the White House today. It's the Crown Prince's first visit in 7 years. U.S. intelligence found that he approved the operation that killed and dismembered Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi in Turkey. Meanwhile, Trump has announced the U.S. will sell F-35 fighter jets to Saudi Arabia. The Trump administration is proposing to scale back federal protection of some U.S. waterways. NPR's Nate Rott has more.
For decades, courts, presidential administrations, and interest groups have argued about what specific waterways qualify for federal protection under the Clean Water Act. Industry or individuals need federal permits to pollute a federally protected waterway, and many farming, ranching, and developer groups argue that the 1972 law has been too widely applied. The Environmental Protection Agency says its new proposed definition of what waterways qualify should give those groups relief. An analysis by the Natural Resources Defense Council finds that 85% of the country's wetlands will no longer be protected under the new proposal. And wetlands, the environmental group points out, provide drinking water, flood protection, and wildlife habitat. Nate Rott, NPR News.
A federal judge has decided not to sentence a former Alaska Airlines pilot to prison. Joseph Emerson had pleaded guilty to trying to turn off the engines of a passenger jet in flight over Oregon 2 years ago. It landed safely. Emerson says he wanted to take responsibility for his actions. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Imaginable Futures, funding programs in the U.S. with the goal of ensuring young children and their parents get the education they need to thrive. Learn more at ImaginableFutures.com. This is NPR.
KEXE means a lot to people, including our member services manager, Heather Johnson.
Had a little baby. He never stopped screaming for 2 years. He has since substituted that for talking nonstop. But those first.
Shout out to Alex.
Yeah, shout out to Alex. Great kid, terrible baby. There was a lot of screaming, not much sleeping. So the radio was like constantly like my friend. Like, oh my gosh, thank goodness the morning show is on. And, oh, now there's somebody playing great music and everything. And it was just such a relief. And then I was working from home at that point, so I wasn't going into the office and seeing adults anyway. So it was just nice to hear adult voices, you know what was going on in this new town and know what we could do, like what I could take this little screaming thing to.
We need your support now. Go to KEXE.org. I'm Heidi Holton. Thank you for being a part of this community.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California. The House of Representatives is expected to vote today to release documents related to the convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein.
Now, the House vote alone would not do the job, but it would be a victory for people who want to see the Justice Department's information on Epstein. He was believed to have abused many underage women before his death in jail in 2019. The Justice Department said earlier this year there was nothing worth releasing. People who doubt this include Annie Farmer, one of Epstein's accusers, who spoke yesterday on NPR's Morning Edition.
There's a piece about accountability, wanting people that not just participated in these crimes, but also that allowed them, that funded them, that looked the other way. I think there's a reckoning for all of that that needs to happen. And so this idea that, no, there's nothing more to see here, we don't buy it.
NPR congressional correspondent Barbara Sprunt is with us. Barbara, so how does this congressional action work?
Well, it would compel the Justice Department to release all unclassified files. So that's records, documents, communications, all investigation materials, essentially, within 30 days. And that includes documents related to Epstein's death. As a reminder, the administration has already released thousands of files to the House Oversight Committee, documents that also include names of other people connected to Epstein. But there are still more files that haven't been made public. And there's renewed interest in this. Democrats on the panel recently released emails where Epstein told a journalist that President Trump, quote, knew about the girls, unquote, seemingly referring to the people Epstein was allegedly trafficking. The president has previously said he had a falling out with Epstein many years ago, and he has not been tied to any wrongdoing.
All right, so say this passes the House, the files still would have a few steps to go before they're made public.
That's right. And there are a few question marks here. What is the scope of what's in these files? We know that the measure gives some latitude to the Justice Department to withhold or redact portions of them, including documents that could jeopardize active investigations. So could that lead to delays? President Trump has already called for an investigation into Epstein's alleged ties to prominent Democrats, for example. And another big question mark is the Senate. Will leadership bring this for a vote in that chamber? I think if there's a lot of support from Republicans in the House, it ups the chances of this moving in the Senate.
So after the House, after the Senate, then it goes to President Trump's desk.
That's right. And he has said that he would sign it if it comes to his desk. But an interesting element in this, he already has the authority to direct the Justice Department to release documents. He did that in other cases with documents related to the investigations of the assassinations of the Kennedys and Martin Luther King Jr., for example. But that's not what's happening here. Instead, the House is forcing a vote that would compel the administration to release the documents. Big difference.
Wondering, Barbara, what you make of that reversal from President Trump on whether Republicans should back the measure or not.
Yeah, that was a major U-turn. I think it speaks to how important this issue is to the base. I think it's notable that there was a pressure campaign from the White House to convince key Republicans, including some of his most vocal supporters, no less, not to sign the petition to force a vote on this. That didn't work. And to me, it shows that this is an area where the president doesn't have a firm grip on the House. I think the writing was on the wall that a lot of Republican House members were prepared to vote yes for this, with or without the White House's blessing. So the president's about face could be a way of giving into, you know, giving the go-ahead to something that was already coming.
That's NPR's Barbara Sprunt. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
People watching this include Joyce Vance. She's a former U.S. attorney for the Northern District of Alabama. She now writes a Substack called Civil Discourse, and she's on the line from Birmingham. Good morning.
Good morning.
Is there any reason the president could not simply release everything today on his own?
Absolutely none. He has that authority.
Wow. Okay. So we don't need this vote. We don't need the Senate to vote. We don't need the president to sign anything. He could just tell the attorney general what to do?
He could do that. And of course, the reason that we're having a congressional vote reflects the fact that Congress, under the Constitution, has the duty to engage in oversight of the executive branch when it believes it has stumbled.
Okay. Let me ask, though, the president in the last few days, in addition to saying, okay, I'm for this House vote, he has also instructed the attorney general to investigate Democrats who are named in these recently released letters from a House committee. Of course, he's not telling the attorney general to investigate him. He's mentioned more than 1,000 times, but investigate his political opponents, yes. Does that investigation get in the way of releasing everything because suddenly there may be an active criminal investigation?
I suppose that there's a difference here between what's actually happening and what should happen, because it's clear that this is a pretextual investigation. For one thing, the Southern District of New York and a very highly esteemed U.S. Attorney's Office has had a case open, and it only closed earlier this year, followed by the July 7 DOJ announcement that that investigation didn't uncover any evidence that the office could predicate an investigation on or charge additional uncharged third parties. There's been no explanation for what has changed since then. And so opening an investigation in this context really looks like it's just something that the administration can now hang its hat on to try to refuse to turn over all of these documents to Congress.
However fraudulent you may believe it to be, can they get away with that? They go to the judge. They say, listen, we've got to protect these files.
So DOJ historically has had a deal with Congress where Congress defers to DOJ when it has an ongoing criminal investigation and waits until the criminal investigation is concluded to engage in its oversight function. Congress doesn't have to do that, of course. It could push the point here. And you, I think, landed on one of the key points, which is that Donald Trump is not included within the ambit of this renewed DOJ investigation. So there's no reason that Congress, for instance, couldn't push to get documents that involve Donald Trump.
Oh, this is very interesting. So Congress might say, okay, we don't need the files about Bill Clinton since you want Bill Clinton investigated or, you know, whatever, Democratic donor, but it wouldn't apply to Trump. Another question here. The Attorney General, as you noted, back in July, said nothing more in these files warrants a criminal prosecution of any kind. Then the president tells her to fire this back up, and she says, yes, sir, right away, sir. Does that undermine any future action that she might take?
Well, what it should do is it should unfortunately undermine public confidence in what's going on at the Justice Department, because cases are indicted based on the facts and the law, not based on the president's preference. And because all of that happened in public with Donald Trump in essence, posting on social media and Pam Bondi responding to his orders on social media. That really sets up, I think, an inference that we've reached the dangerous point where the White House is telling the Justice Department what to do, rather than the Justice Department making decisions on the basis of the facts and the law.
I want to follow up on that point because that's become more and more blatant as the year has gone on, and the White House and its defenders have offered a defense of essentially whataboutism, that this is the way that it always is, that this is the way that Biden did it, that this is the way the Democrats did it, and they're just doing what other people are doing. This is the response. They claim that what they're doing is, in fact, a response to the past weaponization of the Justice Department. You spent a couple of decades at the Justice Department. Is this normal?
It's not normal, and it's painful for everyone who's ever worked at or continues to work at the Justice Department, because that tradition of independence really stems from the post-Watergate moment, where it was very clear that there had to be a distinction between DOJ and the White House. That has always been observed until very recently.
And there's no president who told you what to do when you were in there?
No, no president who told us what to do. We did our cases on the basis of the facts and the law. That's what should happen here, too.
Joyce Vance is a former United States attorney. Her book, Giving Up is Unforgivable, A Manual for Keeping a Democracy, is out now. Thanks for taking the time.
Thanks for having me.
Hackers are pulling the strings far beyond cyberspace. A research team has uncovered details of a scam to hijack real-world cargo shipments. Here's NPR cybersecurity correspondent Jenna McLaughlin.
For many years, criminals have been stealing valuable cargo as it travels around the world. Here's Selena Larson, a threat intelligence analyst at cybersecurity firm Proofpoint.
We think about from the old West days of the train robbers, like Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid were targeting, you know, overground freight. They were targeting rail and would steal money, steal goods that were being shipped over land. And this is sort of the natural evolution of this.
By the natural evolution, she means incorporating cybercrime. Now, hackers are helping hijackers get a head start. Here's Ulla Viladson, another researcher at Proofpoint, who said his team has been tracking cybercriminals who are breaking into freight companies.
I noticed that there were some posts on Reddit that talked about the problem of having cargo stolen and then tracing that back to carriers who had compromised accounts.
What he saw on Reddit matched Proofpoint's data. Cybercriminals were using companies' internal software to infiltrate their operations. The hackers would use stolen accounts to bid on cargo loads, then tip off criminals who would steal the goods. Larson says she found evidence of hijackers going after trucks full of energy drinks, for example, whose sale might be illegal in other countries. The scheme is very lucrative.
We found that it's literally a $35 billion industry. Like, that's the estimated losses from cargo theft overall, and that dwarfs other cybercrime.
More money than ransomware, even. A highly publicized kind of attack where criminals hold victims' data hostage. This cyber-enabled hijacking quite literally crosses borders, between jurisdictions and countries, and from the digital space to the physical. Larson says it's going to take a team effort to start to solve this problem.
It really requires collaboration between everyone involved and, you know, sharing information, identifying these trends, making people care about it also is going to be really important.
That work is already underway. The researchers say truckers and cargo companies are becoming more aware that they could be targets of hackers now too, along with their precious cargo. Jen McLaughlin, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
It's 6:19. Thanks for tuning in. This is People Powered KAXC. We do have more news coming up from Morning Edition. It is from National Public Radio. Up next, we are learning about clean energy jobs in Illinois. Weather around our region, we are looking at a sunny day with highs in the low to mid 40s. Support for this program comes from Sanford Health with primary care locations in Bemidji and across the upper Midwest. Sanford Health is committed to providing care close to home. Learn more at sanfordhealth.org. We'd also like to thank the Third Coast Chamber Collective, presenting chamber music up north, featuring an internationally renowned accordion and violin ensemble from Poland at Co-House on November 20th at 7 p.m. Tickets available at thirdcoastchambercollective.com. We've got lots of nature news for you coming up with John Latimer and student reports from around the state of Minnesota. John's full report coming up an hour from now. You can listen to the Season Watch Pod. Charlie Mitchell, myself, I'm Heidi Holton, and John Latimer, and a rotating cast of characters. This week, we're going to be looking at lots of different things as the seasons change. This podcast is for the curious, filled with the delights of nature. New episodes come out on Thursdays. Find it at Spotify, Apple, and our website.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from BetterHelp, committed to making mental well-being a priority and offering support in taking on everything life demands. With therapists available to communicate via video, chat, or phone. At betterhelp.com/public. From the Kresge Foundation with Pathbreakers, a podcast about transforming communities through innovation. From revolutionizing higher education to supporting artists who are driving change. Pathbreakers is available on podcast platforms. And from the University of Maryland Libraries, dedicated to making UMD's research available to everyone and advancing open access for the public good. More at lib.umd.edu.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. President Biden once promised to lift up American workers by creating good jobs in clean energy. The U.S. committed a lot of money to that. President Trump's distaste for renewables scrambled that plan, but the effort is still alive in Illinois. NPR's Andrea Hsu reports from Chicago.
Asante McKinney's first job out of school was as a dental assistant. For a while, she thought this might be my calling.
I enjoyed it. Like I always tell people, good health starts at the mouth.
But in the back of her mind lingered a long-held dream, getting into the skilled trades.
You know, they say that's hard labor, but I like to use my hands. I like thinking. I just didn't know how to go about doing it until I found Hire 360.
Hire 360, that's a nonprofit that recruits people from underserved communities for good-paying jobs in construction. I meet McKinney inside their training center, a converted warehouse. Through a 9-week program, she refreshed her math skills, earned safety certifications, and landed a spot as a trainee with the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. Already, she's on job sites installing high-voltage wiring.
I'm very hands-on, more than what I thought I would be allowed to be, which is really good for me.
Now, McKinney is hoping, striving for a career as a union electrician, and she has the state's backing. In 2021, Illinois passed the Climate and Equitable Jobs Act, a landmark bill talked about as a model for the country. It set a goal for Illinois to get to 100% clean energy by 2050, with a workforce that includes those deemed equity eligible. That includes people like McKinney, who live in communities that have long faced discrimination and heavy pollution. Pat Devaney of the Illinois AFL-CIO took part in negotiations.
So equity and making sure our workforce was diverse around clean energy was very much a top priority of labor.
If that sounds familiar, it's because the Biden administration would later advance those same goals. The administration allocated billions of dollars in federal grants and clean energy tax credits to encourage contractors to use union labor and seek a diverse talent pool. The hope was those incentives would create millions of middle-class jobs. But President Trump isn't a fan.
It's a green new scam, greatest scam in history, the greatest in history.
So now tax credits for wind and solar projects are getting phased out within a few years, far sooner than planned. And the vision for pulling historically disadvantaged workers into clean energy jobs has gotten murky. In a statement to NPR, White House spokesman Kush Desai wrote, "Instead of DEI boondoggles that accomplish nothing, the Trump administration is laying the groundwork for Americans of all backgrounds to help build our next golden age." Still in Illinois, Pat Devaney says the work is getting results.
I don't see Illinois changing course one bit in how we're approaching renewable investments, climate change, and certainly how we approach DEI and promoting diversity in our workforce.
He says Illinois is still pouring hundreds of millions of dollars of its own into the transition to clean energy. The problem is contractors were anticipating those generous federal tax credits on top of state investments. Devaney fears the early sunsetting of those tax credits will lead contractors to cancel planned projects, costing Illinois tens of thousands of jobs. What's more, they may not plan new projects.
I still don't think people can wrap their mind around the massive amounts of investments that they were going to make and the positive impact that was going to have on our country in terms of job creation.
Now, not everything has come to a screeching halt. In fact, right now, there's a rush to get renewable projects going while the tax credits are still available. Asante McKinney is excited about her new career and what it will mean for her family. She and her wife live on the south side of Chicago with their two-year-old son.
You know, he's an amazing kid, but I always ask myself, can I see my son walking to school from over here? No.
She's already imagining the day when she can buy a house elsewhere.
That was a big part of why I wanted to get into the trades, is for better living.
And also to be able to point to projects and tell her son, I had something to do with that. Andrea Hsu, NPR News, Chicago.
The shutdown is over. SNAP food benefits from the federal government are being reinstated. Still, though, food needs remain. A nonprofit called Lasagna Love organizes volunteers to make and deliver free lasagnas for anyone who asks. These people sound like pasta angels. As Macy Lipkin reports for member station KUER, they're working their way through a backlog of requests that mounted during the shutdown.
In the suburbs of Salt Lake County, Lori McDougall knocks on a stranger's door. After a minute, a teenage boy swings it open. McDougall hands him a heavy bag with fresh-baked lasagna, garlic bread, salad, and cookies.
Yay! We're so happy you answered! Lasagna dinner from Lasagna Love.
Thank you.
We're so happy that you get to have some warmth tonight.
All right, thank you.
Thanks so much.
Scenes like this play out across the U.S., Lasagna Love is in all 50 states and three other countries. The roughly 2,500 requests they get a week shot up to about 10,000 in late October when people found out their SNAP benefits would be interrupted. Dia Hobbs is a regional coordinator for Lasagna Love. She reads a note from a family that says they're on a very tight budget.
Another family says, we were cut on food stamps and we are really struggling. Another one, furloughed employee, need help with food, having financial troubles.
Hobbs knows a homemade lasagna won't fix everything, but it brings some kindness into people's lives.
The world is hard and can be tough, but we're all in it together, and that's a message that we all need.
Is there more boxes of noodles that it's open?
Earlier today, Lori McDougall had about 20 friends over for her 63rd birthday party. Together, they made 30 lasagnas. She found out about Lasagna Love through her church and decided to go big for her first time volunteering.
I just feel like I've received gifts all these years, and the last few years have just kind of looked for a way to serve and to give back.
Her friends spooned ricotta onto layers of oven-ready noodles, then smothered the trays with tomato sauce and shredded cheese. Some lasagnas went in to bake. The rest would be picked up by other volunteers and dropped off with heating instructions.
Excitement, excitement, they're coming out of the oven.
You could hear the cheese sizzling, and the kitchen smelled like a pizza shop.
All right, I think they should be hot and ready.
Today, one lasagna goes to a working mom with two teenagers, another to a woman with breast cancer. For NPR News, I'm Macy Lipkin in Sandy, Utah.
This is NPR News.
The U.S. needs more truck drivers. Could updates to trucks, like cameras and driver assist technology, make long hauls more comfortable and keep drivers around for longer?
I would say that this truck's easier to drive than most cars nowadays.
I'm Scott Detrow. We lift up the hood on the future of trucking on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you. You can tune in to All Things Considered coming up this afternoon at 4 o'clock. It's here on People Powered KAXE. It's almost 6:30. I'm Heidi Holton with John Latimer.
Morning, Heidi.
Good morning.
Boy, that last little note about the truckers and truck driving.
Yeah.
It just caused my head to go to a whole bunch of old truck driving songs. Yeah. Well,
now I'm thinking Smoking the Bandit, you know.
Oh, no, not even that. I've never actually seen that movie, but I was thinking of the Sleep of the Wheel. Mama hated diesels so bad.
Hey.
Guess it had something to do with dad, you know.
That's funny. Second day in a row, we've talked about Sleep at the Wheel because our album of the week is produced by Ray Benson.
Oh, really?
Sleep at the Wheel, yeah. We'll be hearing that this morning by Joshua Headley.
All right. Well, I can't wait. Another trucking song, yeah.
But well, today we're dipping in, as always, to nature, and we are on the cusp of lots of changes. There are changes. We're moving into different seasons. We'll be hearing from students across the state, and Charlie Mitchell's going to join us later because the naturalist from Saxon Bog is going to be with us.
Yeah, Clinton Ninos is going to join us this morning for a discussion about, well, just what to look for. We thought about talking about the birds at Saxon Bog, but Clinton said he hadn't been there for a week or more, so he couldn't give us an up-to-date report, but we'll talk about what birds you will be able to see, you should be able to see at the Saxon Bog, and we'll also talk about just all of the things that make up winter. And if you're out and about, as I have been, we're going to highlight a few things that are still green on the forest floor during the phenology show. So stay tuned for that.
Not just buckthorn.
Not just buckthorn. No, we're going right down to the ground. We're going to be looking at ground pine and ground cedar and gold thread, hepatica. Yeah, there's a lot of flowers, a lot of plants that don't turn a fall color, that just remain green through the winter. And if you could dig down through the snow in the middle of January, you would find those leaves just as green as you'll find them today. So I'm just wandering about in the woods and seeing what catches my eye. And the last few days, the things that have caught my eye are those little green things down at the ground level. Why are you still green? In some cases, it's chemistry. Sometimes plants just don't have enough available chemistry in the soil to go through the sacrifice of retiring their leaves. So they keep their leaves through the winter, and in the springtime, as soon as the snow melts back, they can be making sugar.
Well, the good news is, John, we don't have snow on the ground. That means you still have a possibility of ice before snow for your ice skating.
And I got a note from Joel Rosen yesterday saying that Park Lake was pretty much frozen yesterday. And I suspect that Crooked Lake, I didn't get down there yesterday afternoon to look. I was being a logger. And what do you do in the fall? What changes in your season? Well, it finally cools off enough so I can go run my chainsaw without ending up in a bath of sweat. So that's what I do, among other things. Yeah.
We were doing the normal once a week, bring wood in the house kind of thing over the weekend. Throwing it in and, you know, getting all that stuff for the winter ahead to stay warm. Our student reports, it looks like Charlie's saying that most of them, almost all of them, are reporting on ice forming in some way. So
yep.
We've got that to look forward to. That's coming up. Looks like our temperatures for today, 42 to 43 around the region. Sunny skies. Increasing clouds tonight, 24 to 26. The high is going to be near 40 for tomorrow, and there's a slight chance of rain in the afternoon and rain likely overnight. It looks like 30 to 34 for the overnight temperatures. And partly sunny with highs 39 to 43 by Thursday.
That's good. I'll be out with the students on Thursday, and we'll have more things to see. We had some pretty amazing discoveries this last week that we'll talk about when we get to the phenology show.
We want to thank folks who have already been helping us out. KAXC was chosen for Newsmatch 2025. It's a national campaign that supports local nonprofit newsrooms like ours. You helped us get here, and now your gift can go even further. We have over $35,000 in matching funds to support strong local journalism across northern Minnesota. Your gift will be matched 3-1, up to $1,000 while funds remain. The campaign runs through the end of the year. You can give now at kaxe.org. John, I know I've asked you this before, but how, your thoughts on the last 3.5 years or so with the KAXE newsroom?
Wow, just phenomenal. I mean, I tend to be disconnected from, especially from local news, because I just don't subscribe to the local paper. I don't, you know, follow a lot of the other radio stations that might be broadcasting local news. I'd be quite surprised to find if that were true. But with KAXE, it's all of a sudden, here's this newsroom filling me with all sorts of stories about things that are happening right in my neighborhood, which is something that I would otherwise be totally ignorant of. So
yeah,
I find it very, very informative, and I find myself kind of listening attentively.
Well, and there's always stories, like our top story right now is about a Red Lake charter school that has partnered with a nonprofit. They bring a classroom to the water. We've got this great photo of students on the water on Red Lake learning there. They have a new pontoon, and they give family boat rides and hot chocolate. That was happening on November 12th.
Ooh.
So cool stuff. Also, information about swimming, state swimming, and medals of Northlanders, and all kinds of different things, including resources for things like food shelves and community meals and soup kitchens around our region. Find it all at kaxe.org. And if you can, the news match is there. We are going to be matched up to $35,000. You can find more at kaxe.org. Thanks to everybody who has done this. Your impact can be tripled by giving today. We've got National Native News coming up next. We are learning about a Native American woman and her family that are thankful that she has not been detained and potentially deported by ICE. On Veterans Day, 24-year-old Letitia Jacobo completed a short sentence at the Polk County Jail in Des Moines, Iowa for a traffic infraction, and she was supposed to have been released at midnight, but things took an odd turn. We're going to hear her story coming up next.
A Native American? Goodness. if they ever came to power, we'd all be gone, right? Support for KAXE comes from Woodwork Homes, dedicated to the art of building in northern Minnesota by constructing handcrafted new homes and offering remodeling services. More at woodworksmn.com.
Coats for the Community is distributing winter gear for those in need. That's today from 5 to 7 at St. Peter's Catholic Church in Park Rapids. And the Itasca Housing Resource Team is hosting Soup on the Street. That's tomorrow on the grounds of Old Central School in Grand Rapids from 3 to 5. You can stand in solidarity with those experiencing housing insecurity and hunger. Donations of hats, mittens, and scarves will be accepted, and soup will be served.
We receive support from Dragonfly Coffee, located in Central Square Mall in Grand Rapids, featuring a scratch bakery and offering espresso, bubble tea, and more, empowering inclusion and community through employment, special orders available, and more at drinkdragonfly.com.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A Native American woman and her family are thankful that she's not detained and potentially deported by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. Brian Bull of Buffalo's Fire has the story.
On Veterans Day, 24-year-old Letitia Jacobo completed a short sentence at the Polk County Jail in Des Moines, Iowa, for a traffic infraction. She was supposed to have been released at midnight, but things took an odd turn.
I don't know how to explain it. I don't know how to put it in words. It was shocking. I was like, how do I have an ICE hold and I'm Native American? It was just weird. It was just crazy.
J. Jacobo's mom, Erica Burns, learned that her daughter was placed under an ICE detainer and was worried. Both women are members of the Salt River Pima Maricopa Indian community and therefore legal U.S. citizens. Jacobo's aunt, Maria Nunez, said her sister sprung into action.
Being the holiday that day, we couldn't do much. And here on her reservation side of the family was jumped on the media and reached out to everyone and whoever we could, because we didn't want her removed and sent to we don't know where.
Nunez says the tribal police chief called into corrections officials to vouch for Jacobo's citizenship. And an investigator learned that another inmate at the jail had the same last name as Jacobo. A spokesman for the Polk County Sheriff's Office said it was all a clerical mix-up, and staff have been talked to about preventing repeat errors. Again, Leticia Jacobo.
I'm very thankful for having family members and people out here, because if I didn't, who knows what would have happened. I would have just unknowingly went to ICE custody. So it would have been a scary moment.
Many Native people and supporters are calling this a case of racial profiling, and Jacobo is weighing a lawsuit. For now, though, she plans to celebrate the holiday season with her family. Maria Nunez says she's happy that her niece is safe.
I'm just so proud to be Native American and have all the love and support in knowing that we're all ready to fight and protect what's ours.
Since the Trump administration ramped up its immigration crackdown, tribes have complained of ICE confronting their enrolled citizens. Many have issued guidance on their rights and what documentation to present if detained. Neither the Des Moines ICE office nor the Salt River Pima Maricopa Indian community returned requests for comment. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
The Colorado River has long been considered a lifeline for the Southwest. As KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports, one Arizona tribe is now acknowledging the waterway as having the same rights and legal protections as tribal members.
The Colorado River Indian Tribes, or CRIT, would not say whether it was unanimous, but the nine council members still voted to recognize personhood for the namesake river under tribal law. It comes at a pivotal time when sustained drought threatens this natural resource CRIT considers a living entity, running parallel to the tribe's nearly 300,000-acre reservation along the California border. This measure also tasked tribal councils to take the Colorado River's needs under consideration amid an uncertain future on two fronts, climate change and ongoing water negotiations. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
Tribal leaders from across the country are gathered in Seattle for the National Congress of American Indians annual convention and marketplace. Leaders are tackling top issues facing their communities, from economic development, education, climate, to language and culture. Additionally, a youth convention is taking place. Both gatherings continue through Friday. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding in part by the Annenberg Foundation and the Ford Foundation. It's 6:43. Thanks so much for tuning in. This is People Powered KAXE. We're going to get a little sample of that album of the week that I mentioned, John Latimer.
Oh, good. Yeah. I can't wait to hear.
Produced by Ray Benson of Asleep at the Wheel. It is All Hat by Joshua Headley. He is a country musician. He's dabbled with varying kinds of country over the years, and this is a love letter to Western swing, also known as country jazz. We're going to take a listen here to Mean Mama Blues.
Lord, I hate to see that evening sun go down. Yes, I do. Lord, I hate to see that evening sun go down. 'Cause I know that's when my woman gonna run all over town. But she told me that she loved me. There were no told me that she loved me. There were no one but me. Oh, but Lord, she got to stepping. Now I'm down in misery.
Oh, mercy.
Not always that John Latimer's sort of dancing in our studio.
That's my kind of dance music there. I could have a lot of fun with that. It's swaying around the dance floor, you bet.
Joshua Headley, brand new release. It's our album of the week. Mean Mama Blues is what we're listening to right now. Features a co-write with North Dakota, now based in Texas, musician Brennan Lee. And there is this is a record that's meant to be heard and experienced live in a dance hall. At its core, Western Swing is just dance music. Bob Wills didn't play theaters. He played dance halls.
Yeah, yeah. I've been to a dance hall or two. Not in a few years, but I'd go back. I might need some ibuprofen to get the joints loosened up. But a little of that music could get me moving for sure. I enjoyed that very much. Support for KAXE comes from Lady Sippers N.A. Bottle Shop, located in downtown Deer River, Itasca County's only N.A. bottle shop, offering ready-to-drink options, ingredients for craft cocktails, gifts, and more. Info available at ladysippers.com.
Don't forget, we'd love to hear from you. Our question of the week has to do with what happens when fall turns to winter for you at your house. You know, have you started doing the changeover? A lot of folks here have been cleaning out closets or making sure they got gloves, donating old coats, doing that kind of stuff. Making a little cozier, going to bed earlier. John Latimer's giving me weird eyes there. You can text us your stories.
Cleaning out closets? No.
218.
Don't even go in there.
326-1234. Let us know.
I do actually make a change. I have a different set of socks for winter. Oh. I have a different set of, well, I've got my long underwear to dig out. All of my short-sleeved shirts kind of go to the back of the closet. So I do a few things like that.
But yeah.
It's more natural, just kind of a flow. It's not like I pick a day and go, oh, today I'm going to move right. All this. It's just not going to happen that way.
Yeah. Well, but you're getting firewood. You've got the pile ready at the splitter, and you're gonna be getting all that stuff.
I work a year ahead. I'm probably a year and a half ahead right now, but I will finish that up, and then during the dead of winter I will kind of just nestle in and fill the wood chute a couple of times. Well, it's usually about twice a month I have to fill the wood chute, and then once it's full it lasts me a couple of weeks, and depending on how cold it gets.
Mm-hmm.
We receive support from Cass Soil and Water Conservation District, partnering with landowners in Cass County on lakeshore restoration projects by offering live plants and seed mixes, shoreline and woodland workshops, and restoring cost-sharing programs. More information available at casswcd.org. It is time now for our student phenology. Our student phenology is funded in part by the Minnesota Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund. Our phenology talkbacks are produced by Charlie Mitchell. And our first report this week comes from Lindsay Engel's class at North Star Elementary School in Virginia.
This is Charles.
Eli.
Maddie.
Anaya.
Gino.
Reese.
And Aiden.
With a report from North Star Elementary on November 6, 2025. We saw the first snow of the season on October 22nd.
Yesterday morning on November 5th, Mr. Galloway saw a blue heron flying over Gilbert. On Reese's camera at his house, he caught a bear going through his garbage on November 28th in Virginia. Hopefully that bear is heading to bed soon.
On Monday, November.
That was from last week, John Latimer.
Oh, I wondered.
I got to remember what dates. That's the hard thing, right?
Well, and I was listening to all the names of the students that were participating in... And looking at my hard copy and going, wait a minute.
this time of the year, it's really hard for me to realize that today's November 18th.
Yeah. Thanksgiving is coming up in a week and 2 days.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. So here we go with Lindsay Engel's class in Virginia.
This is Porter.
Asher.
Austin.
Haley.
Ellie.
Peyton.
Emma.
With a report from North Star Elementary on November 14th, 2025.
Many of us were able to get outside and enjoy the Northern Lights show on the evening of November 12th. It was an amazing display.
We have some ice reports for you as of November 13th.
Ellis reported that Sand Lake in Britt has some ice forming along the shoreline. The water is frozen a couple feet from the shore out into the lake.
Xander noticed that the ice on Everett's Bay in Lake Vermilion goes out about 20 feet from the shoreline. 2 days before, it was only frozen about 5 feet out from the shore.
Aiden noticed that there was a thin layer of ice around the shore of Lake Esquimalt outside of Gilbert.
Silver Lake in Virginia was approximately 60% covered by a layer of ice that was only 1.5 millimeters thick. On the morning of November 13, an hour later, we looked again, and only about 45% of the lake had ice. Later in the afternoon, the ice was only covering about 5% of the lake. The high temperature got up to 47 degrees that day. The wind and sun moved and melted the ice quickly.
With cold nights and warmer days, we see a lot of fluctuation in the ice on the lakes. It's fun to be able to see it change from day to day. As always,
keep exploring the great outdoors!
Thank you, Porter, Asher, Austin, Haley, Ellie, Peyton, and Emma. Nice report there. I like the idea of sort of keeping an eye on the area lakes, getting out and checking out the little ice around the shore. And they measured the thickness of the ice on Silver Lake at 1.5 millimeters. That will not hold even my dog. And she can get on ice about half the thickness that holds me. So, 1 to 2 millimeters is not enough ice for anything other than observing from the shoreline. I did find it kind of interesting that they had gotten out, many of them, and had a chance to check out the Northern Lights. It was an amazing display, and I hope that you had a chance to check in on some of that as well. Our next report comes from Colin Cody's class at East Rapids Elementary School in Grand Rapids.
Hello, my name is Penelope Reuter. This is our phenology report from Mr. Cody's third grade classroom at East Rapids Elementary. It had been much too long since our last walk. All trees are now bare. We found deer tracks and deer and rabbit scat. The mast of acorns now have been mostly taken. We witnessed cattails spreading by wind and hitchhikers by hitching. With there and the scat, we saw 3 of 5 methods. We found that there was a varmint hole too deep to be a rabbit's. Our raven carcass had lost feathers and skin. Remember to stay safe and have fun, Penelope.
Thank you, Penelope. Nice report. We did have a nice walk. It had been a while since we'd gotten together. Various and sundry vacations and my leaving, and it had been too long, but we did get out and the kids had a great time. We did find a lot of deer and rabbit scat, and the acorn mast that we had been watching was considerably reduced. Cattails spreading their seeds by wind, hitchhikers by hitching. We also saw those that those like the buckthorn and others that are eaten and then pooped out. And so we did see three of the five methods seeds disperse. The other two, of course, are ploppers. Those are acorns. And then poppers, and those would be a good example of those would be the orange flower, Think John, spreading, or spotted touch-me-not. They have a little green seed pod, like a think of a banana about 1 inch long. If you touch that when it's ripe, it just pops and explodes, and the seeds go flying. So thanks, Penelope. Thanks for the third graders at East Rapids. Nice report there. Thank you for that very much. Our next report comes from Lee Jackson and Darcy Rolfe's classes at the North Shore Community School near Duluth.
Hello from the North Shore Community School on the North Shore of Lake Superior. My name is Sadie, and I'm your phrenologist for this week. On Monday, November 10th, Sigrid noticed that the stream was completely frozen over where she does horseback riding. On Tuesday, November 11th, the preschoolers also noticed the puddle in their class spot was frozen over. Last week, the puddle was all liquid. They also noticed ice forming in Schmidt Creek, and parts of the stream were completely covered in ice and didn't break when they threw sticks on it. Other parts of the stream only had sections of ice with liquid water in between. Aurora saw the aurora borealis on the night of November 11th. The sky was filled with lots of reds and greens and shifting patterns. That night, the aurora borealis had a strength of G2 moderate. Gavin saw the aurora over his house brightly glowing on November 12th. That night, the aurora had a strength of defined G4 severe. On Tuesday, November 11th, Raina and Miss Beagle's class found a bristly bellflower that is still flowering. It had a few purple petals still attached. That same day, the preschoolers found some red berries on the forest floor and traced the berries back to a hawthorn tree. The hawthorn had a few dried berries still attached. On Tuesday, November 11th, the preschoolers found a small caterpillar in the woods. It was curled up under the leaves, but once they put it down, the caterpillar unrolled and started crawling around the ground. They think the caterpillar was looking for a place to hibernate for the winter. This concludes the phrenology report. Have a great week and be observant.
Thank you very much, Sadie. As always, the kids in Duluth get a great background in the natural history of the area, based primarily on the fact that their teachers are engaged and very, very interested. And it's not only the fifth or the sixth graders, they're the ones who are providing the reports. But the one thing I really like about their reports is that they're always including all of the teachers and students from across the school. And it is really cool that that the school does phenology, not just the students in the sixth grade classes, but everybody in the school is sort of attuned to the world that they're living in. And that is really, really cool. And Aurora got to see the aurora borealis on November 11th. And they called that one G2 moderate. And then the next night it went to G4 severe. And I think that was the night of the 13th. And it was absolutely astonishing. It was so bright, so intense. I have never, ever seen aurora quite that strong. And they have found a bristly bellflower still in flower, purple petals attached. Preschoolers found some red berries that they traced back to the hawthorn. Let's see, snow buntings, bald eagle flying over the orchard, found a skull of a small deer, found a lot of the animals structure, leg bones, shoulder blades, clumps of fur, probably a coyote or wolf came across it and killed it, and they were able to see the remains. And a small caterpillar curled up in the woods. The caterpillar unrolled when it warmed up and began crawling around. And we will have to